Hi everyone, welcome to the Blind Series podcast. If you've been following along, you know that you've heard a couple of the chapters from Blind Influence, which was the first book in the series, and that audiobook is available for you out on Downpour and I believe in Audible and a bunch of other places that you could do a search for, or go to my website and there'll be a link there. So blindseries.com. LindaFissler.com. So, what I thought I would be doing, in addition to providing a little bit of background on the books, but also do some readings from time to time on this podcast as well. So, we'll be starting actually with book two of the Blind series called Blind Persuasion. We're going to do chapter one. So, this is kind of like a live reading. So, hang with me. So, I might stumble on some words and I'll apologize in advance for that. But, it's very live and it's very, real for you all, and it's very real for me. So bear with me while I read through these chapters. And this particular one is chapter one, starts in January of 1980, and it starts in a little town in western North Carolina. So here we go. Chapter one, January 1980, Blind Persuasion. Darkness. Winter was always dark and gray, even on the sunniest of days. In the darkness, foreboding thoughts crept into the recesses of a person's mind and soul. Maybe it was because the trees were barren, their charcoal-black branches a shade darker than the gray puffs of clouds that billowed upward, away from yet another gray shape that formed the foothills of the mountains beyond. The darkness became the playground for the demons that feared the light. The only saving graces were the festive complementary colors of red and green. These warm colors brightened the mood, decorated the buildings, and adorned most of the month of December. It was a stark contrast to the bleakest month of the year, January. The joyous refrains became an echo among the inhabitants of this quaint little town nestled in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. The bitter darkness made the labors of the town's inhabitants seem harder than usual. This especially harsh winter weighed heavily on a few souls in particular. The cold, blustery winds whistled outside the windows, giving their demons a voice. Oh, the darkness! Only those who suffer in its demoralizing anxiety can understand the toll it takes on them. A man walked the lonely streets of this small North Carolina town. His new parka was zipped up all the way, and its hood shielded the man's face from the cold. While he had been seen about the town to buy the basic necessities such as food, personal care items, and the libations to ease the pain of what some folks assume was a broken marriage or a refuted lover, he never spoke of his problems. In fact, he never spoke at all. He showed up in their town a month ago and quietly rented one of the vacant houses out by the nearby lake. He didn't bother anyone, and he made it clear he didn't want to be bothered. His beard was wild and unkempt. His emerald green eyes pierced through all the black hair that was getting long and in need of attention. He appeared older than he truly was. Speculating on the man's misfortune became the favorite pastime of the locals. Whole dinner conversations revolved around the latest theory or rumor invented earlier in the day. The only fact that everyone knew about this man was that he was not from these parts. At one point, some people thought the man had left as mysteriously as he arrived. They had not seen him for a number of days. They even admitted that not having him around made their lives boring. But they were wrong. Eventually, the man emerged from the lake cabin once again. He walked through the town as if he had the weight of the world on his shoulders. Walking to the local store, he was aware of the finger-pointing, the gasping, whispering that his appearance had generated. The mailman reported that the stranger had received some mail a few days ago. It was a very nondescript envelope addressed to Smith. The mailman declared that he would be calling him Schmitty, which seemed appropriate. Others only laughed at the mailman's attempt to humanize the odd, lonely man. The man reached the local store in the curious little town. He wasn't going to buy much. After all, he had walked the 7 miles back to the cabin he was renting. Grabbing a small basket, he made his way through the store. He picked up some skim milk, pasta, and sauce, and then at the end of the aisle he eyed some small backpacks. Realizing he could purchase more food and make fewer trips to the town, he tried a black one on over his coat. While it was not as comfortable as he would have liked, he decided he could make it work. He tossed the pack into the basket and moved on to the soup aisle, opting for the dry mixes. Out of the corner of his eye, he noticed that he was being watched. Inquisitive eyes were observing his every move. This made him uncomfortable, so he hurriedly selected some beef and frozen vegetables. He also wanted to stop at the liquor store on his way back. He made his way to the cashier to pay for the items. "Hello," the cashier greeted him in her cheerful southern accent. The man gave her a quick smile, barely noticed beneath his beard and mustache, as he set everything on the black conveyor belt. The young, pretty, dark-haired clerk looked at the man, trying to make eye contact. She thought she felt sorry for him. Maybe it wasn't her sorrow she was feeling, instead feeling sorrow emanating from him. She decided to be brave and asked, "Sir, are you all right? Is there anything I can do to help you?" At first, the man was taken aback by her forwardness. He looked at her, their eyes meeting, and he could tell she was genuine in her concern. The clerk took notice of his bloodshot eyes. The man forced himself to say the first words he had spoken to anyone in 6 weeks. He tried to smile and disguise his voice. "I'm fine, thank you. Y'all don't need to worry about me." He cringed. His attempt to mimic the southern accent was horrible. Inside, he was actually laughing at his pathetic attempt. The clerk wasn't sure if he was mocking her. The fake accent left her confused and speechless. She returned, scanning the items, only speaking to finish the transaction. He opened the backpack and placed the items inside, adjusted the straps, and slung the pack over his shoulder. Giving a nod to those standing in shock after hearing him speak, he started for the doors and walked out of the grocery store. His next stop was the liquor store for the libations that would provide temporary relief from his pain. He grabbed a bottle of gin and a bottle of scotch from the shelf. After paying cash, he placed the bottles in a small pack and readied himself for the long hike back to his cabin. It would be dark by the time he returned. He didn't mind walking, and he wasn't in a hurry to get back. He knew what waited for him in the darkness. It was surprising that he was still haunted by nightmares. They were not the same nightmares from his past, though. These nightmares were a mix of future and past events. In them, a woman he had pulled into his world was killed. Each night when she was shot, he awoke in a cold sweat. He couldn't understand why he was dreaming of her death. Nicole Charbonneau was safe, and the serpent was dead. As he walked to the house in the dark, he took the key out of his coat pocket to unlock the door. After going to the kitchen to unpack the groceries and to start his dinner, he smiled as his mind took him back to the beach house. He closed his eyes, envisioning Nicole unpacking the groceries. Seeing her made him happy, if only for a few minutes. He cherished those images. His smile faded as he recalled his current nightmares and wondered if he had failed her in some way. Why was he having these nightmares? He knew she was safe. He had saved her. So why did the torment continue? Sean shook his head, wondering if his mind would ever accept the truth and whether he would ever be able to sleep well again. Taking off his coat, he threw it on a nearby chair. He then removed his gun and holster. He set them on the counter and decided on soup for dinner. He retrieved a small pot from the cupboard and began to read the instructions on the dry soup bag. As he was preparing the soup, the phone rang. He turned the burner on the stove down and walked across the kitchen to answer the phone, which hung on the wall. "Hello? Sean, it's Charlie." Charlie Dawson was calling from London to check on his agent. "How are you doing?" "I'm fine, Charlie. Did my dad put you up to this?" Sean asked. "No, Sean. As per your wishes, I've told no one where you are." "I'm calling from my home," Charlie answered. I thought you'd be back home by now. If there are any problems, we'll be happy to help you. You do know that, don't you? Sean smiled. I know, Charlie. I can't put my finger on it. But I'm just not ready to come home yet. I'm working through some things here, and it's just taken longer than I thought it would. What things are you working through? Charlie asked with a hint of concern in his voice. For one thing, I'm not sure I want to continue to be with Sis, Sean replied. He was somewhat surprised that came out of his mouth. He had never thought about leaving the Secret Intelligence Service before. Charlie sat quietly for a moment, wondering if Sean was going to elaborate. When he didn't, Charlie gave a bit of a sigh and responded, Well, there are other jobs available that I think you would excel in, so don't be too quick in that decision. I understand. I know that I don't want to be in the field again. I think I've paid my dues, if you know what I mean. I do indeed. With his next question, Charlie's voice took on a hesitation that revealed his concern for Sean. Are you still having nightmares, Sean? There was a long pause. Sean sat down. He wasn't sure he wanted to tell Charlie, but his solitude wasn't helping either. Yes, Sean said quietly, embarrassed to admit it. It isn't the same nightmare, though. Now I dream that it is Nicole that has died. I dream I failed in keeping her safe. Charlie smiled. You didn't fail. Nicole is quite safe. In fact, if you have access to a television there, you might want to turn on the news. Why? Sean asked. You'll be able to see that she is on the arm of our friend, Senator Bobby Jenkins. Charlie said with the sound of a smirk on his face. Sean sat back in his chair, not sure how he felt about this turn of events. Charlie, I've got to go. I've got something on the stove, and well, I'm not that great of a cook to begin with, he said, standing up. Please consider coming home, Sean. We're here to help you. Thank you, Charlie. It's good to hear your voice. Sean really did have to admit hearing from Charlie seemed to help. Goodbye. He hung up the phone and said out loud to no one, So, Nicole, that does make a lot of sense. Senator Jenkins is one lucky fella. He walked back to the stove to stir the soup that was about ready to eat. Maybe it's time to catch up on some news, he said to himself. He walked over to the living room, and for the first time in over a month, he turned on the television. He made trips between the kitchen and the living room. After pouring a bowl of soup, he sat down at a small table and tuned in for the 6:30 news. There was a small part of him that hoped the senator would be on the news with Nicole on his arm so that he could see her with his own eyes. What he didn't understand was the pang of jealousy he felt toward his old friend, Bobby Jenkins. As he watched the news, it seemed in his absence from the world that very little had changed. There was a follow-up report on a beheading in Mecca, a lot of talk about whether or not the U.S. would attend the Summer Olympics in Moscow. One report, though, Sean watched with more interest. The IRA had prematurely detonated a bomb on the Dunmurry train outside of Belfast. The bombing killed 3 people and injured 5. With that report, the news was over. Sean drank the last bit of soup from the bowl and walked over to the television to turn it off. While he had been hopeful he would see Nicole on the screen, he was not sad that he didn't see her. Maybe Charlie misinterpreted what he had seen. Maybe Nicole and Jenkins were just friends. Sean put his hands to his head, trying to squash his thoughts. Why in the world would she ever be interested in you? Sean shook his head. He knew it was time to get on with his life. He needed to understand his feelings and gain control of the demons that still haunted him. He walked back to the kitchen where he cleaned up and put the remainder of the soup in the refrigerator. He caught his reflection in a mirror that hung in the entry of the cabin. He almost didn't recognize himself. He had lost a considerable amount of weight and his face was gaunt. His facial hair did him no favors. He was startled at how he looked and how he had let his demons control him. He needed to get tough with himself again. He couldn't return home looking like this. The sight of him in the mirror made him realize that if he wanted any chance with Nicole, he had to pull himself together. It was time to kick his demons to the wall and out of his life forever. He began to search the house for some paper and a pen. He wanted to write down his thoughts. After he was satisfied that he had captured his fears and any demons that were lurking around him, he burned the paper in the fireplace using matches he had found in a drawer in the kitchen. He watched the paper turn to ashes. The orange flame turned to smoke that rose into the chimney. Sean envisioned his demons leaving him with the smoke. Then, he searched the cabin for a pair of scissors, deciding it was time to get rid of the long hair and beard. As he cut each snip of hair, he knew he was beginning the long journey back from his personal hell. So that's the end of part one of chapter one of Blind Persuasion. And I hope you enjoyed the reading. And the next part two of chapter one still basically is New Year's Day, and it'll be taking place in Washington, D.C. So tune in for that one. Thanks, everyone. Please tell your friends about these blind series and these little podcasts, and we'll catch you next time. Thanks. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Blind Series podcast. We just finished with the last podcast, Chapter 1, Part 1, which takes place in January of 1980, and we found out that Sean is in North Carolina fighting some demons. So now we're going to jump ahead to Part 2, and this is taking place in Washington, D.C. So we're going to start reading this. By the way, Blind Persuasion, Blind Influence, and Blind Alliance. So Blind Influence is the first book in the series. Blind Persuasion is the second book in the series. Blind Alliance is the third book in the series. Currently writing the fourth book in the series called Cloaked. The first three books are available at Amazon and off of my website, blindseries.com or .lindafissler.com. So, okay, let's get back into Chapter 1, January 1980, Part 2, Washington, D.C. Happy New Year, Bobby and Nikki. Mrs. Louise Barker said as she opened the door to their lovely home. Senator and Louise Barker were famous for their New Year's Day parties in Washington. It was an affair that everyone wanted to attend. A number of prestigious insiders counted their blessings to be among the chosen. The party was a bright beacon, keeping the gray doldrums of January at bay, if only for a few more days. Louise always had a theme for her parties, and this year she decided that she would usher in Mardi Gras a full 7 weeks early. She had the house decorated appropriately with beads and masks, a band playing New Orleans jazz, and a fortune teller. She had even hired magicians and drama students to wander around and engage her guests. It certainly felt like you had walked into a house party on Bourbon Street the night before Ash Wednesday. Happy New Year to you, too, Jenkins answered as he gave Louise a kiss on the cheek. You have outdone yourself this time, he added, smiling at the noise and commotion emanating from the other rooms. Happy New Year, Louise, Nicole greeted her with a hug and a kiss on her cheek. Larry is in the great room down the hall, Bobby. I'll take your coats. Louise was an elegant lady, a quality that Nicole envied. Nikki, you must simply visit the fortune teller I've hired. Nicole was unbuttoning her coat and stopped to look at Louise. Why? She blurted out. The tone in her voice caused Louise's smile to fade. Nicole noticed the tone, a tone that showed her aversion to the thought that someone could actually predict what was going to happen in her future. She quickly followed her contemptuous question by firmly stating her belief, or disbelief. I mean, I really don't believe in that sort of thing. She removed her coat and handed it to Louise. I have my reasons, my dear, but mainly because of your circumstances in the past year, Louise replied. She paused a moment to rephrase what she was about to say next. Well, let's just say things are looking up, and you have so much to look forward to this year compared to last year, she smiled. I think you would love to know just what's in store for you. Nicole tilted her head in confusion. What happened to her last year could not have possibly been foretold by a fortune teller. She flipped the lock of her curls from her face while forming her next response. She smiled uncomfortably and answered, Well, I really don't believe that someone can tell me what my future holds. Had someone told me that I would have lost Carol at the end of last year, I would have taken her up on that vacation she showed me just prior to her death. Nicole paused. But then I would never have met Sean. She shook her head, mainly to get the thought of Sean out of it. She smiled, turning her doubtful gaze to Louise. In any case, I do believe I control what happens to me, and I don't think I'm that predictable. You are more predictable than you like to think, my dear, Jenkins chimed in. He put his arm around her and gave her a kiss on the cheek. Nicole returned his look with a surprise. I'd love to see if this fortune teller could guess what did happen to you. Nicole felt a need to defend herself. I consider what happened to me to be abnormal. What are the odds of having another assassin threaten my life or anyone else for that matter? Other than trying to determine if I return to law, I don't have any earth-shattering decisions coming up in my life. Really, Bobby, I'm not that predictable. Nicole gave Jenkins the look that Jenkins knew when he was treading on thin ice. Jenkins smiled at the look he did not fear. He then gave a chuckle as Nicole tried to make the look more menacing. See, even receiving the look from you is predictable. Nicole's mouth curled into a smile as she couldn't stay mad at Jenkins for very long. Louise smiled at them both. Oh, I think there might be one or two earth-shattering decisions in your near future. She winked at Jenkins, who suddenly became embarrassed and started to blush. See what I mean? She and Jenkins laughed as Nicole smiled. Nicole suddenly felt uncomfortable with the thought that she and Jenkins would marry in the coming year. Jenkins' embarrassment made her believe that Louise wasn't far from the truth. Now I really want you to see that fortune teller, Louise said as she handed the coats to the butler who appeared from the adjoining room. I'm not making any promises, Nicole answered. I'll see you later. She turned away from Louise, taking Jenkins's offered hand. Neither of them spoke as they walked down the hallway to the great room. Jenkins was too embarrassed, and Nicole didn't want to start a conversation. She didn't want to get married. It was far too soon. She still had a lot to process with all that had happened before Christmas. Nicole still didn't know what she wanted to do with her life, and now that it had changed so drastically. She smiled as her eyes caught Jenkins gazing at her just before entering the room full of notable guests. Larry Barker, the tall, distinguished senator from the state of Texas, stood out like a sore thumb. Barker was in his late 60s and had the respect of both sides of the aisle. He was known for his negotiating skill, even if some of those negotiations require heavily persuasion. These persuasions were typically accompanied with some kind of dirt acquired from snooping into his opponent's background. Jenkins was sure Barker had a secret room somewhere in the house that contained information on just about everyone. At times, Jenkins wondered just what information Barker had on him. It didn't matter, though, as Jenkins didn't plan on crossing his mentor anytime soon. They worked as a team, which brought both men credence from the others in Congress. When Barker saw Jenkins and Nicole enter the room, he broke away from his conversation to greet him. Hello, Bobby, he said, extending his hand, which Jenkins accepted and leaned in to give Barker a quick hug as well. Happy New Year, Jenkins replied. You too, Barker responded. He returned to Nicole and opened both arms to give her a hug. Happy New Year, Nikki, he said as he took her in his arms. Happy New Year, Nicole answered breathlessly as Baker hugged squeezed all the air out of her. As he let go, she cleared her throat and gave a bit of a chuckle. I don't think I'll ever get used to those bear hugs. Well, seems I'll have to give Bobby some lessons. He should be holding you tight every chance he gets, Barker responded with a sly grin. Nicole didn't like Barker's hugs. She actually found them quite annoying. At the risk of embarrassing Jenkins, she answered, I actually like the way Bobby holds me. It doesn't ruffle the feathers. Jenkins smiled. Jenkins's smile was accompanied by a quick shake of his head. Barker was taken aback for a second, but then he gave a smile and a quick punch to Jenkins' upper arm. Good for you, Baker said, following it with a heavy laugh. You do have your hands full with this one, Bobby. I wouldn't have it any other way, Jenkins replied. That's hard to believe coming from a southern gentleman. I consider myself a modern southern gentleman, Jenkins corrected Barker. I'm very secure in the fact that women are equals. Nicole provides valid counterparts to any number of topics we discuss. Jenkins looked at Nicole and smiled. I find her insights enlightening. Barker smiled at Jenkins. I suppose that is a new way of handling things. Nicole furrowed her brow. I suppose it is, Jenkins replied, while he had the chance. Barker thought that women should be seen and not heard. While his wife provided her opinions, typically it was with other women, and not in the presence of her husband. Nicole began to wonder if Louise ever had any input into Barker's decisions. She recalled a time at a dinner party when she voiced her opinion to Jenkins on legislation that was being discussed. Louise gently took her hand and steered her away from the conversation. It was clear now why she was taken away from the discussion, and it saddened Nicole to realize that her opinion was not welcome. Nikki is very astute in the field of politics, and I do appreciate her point of view, Jenkins continued, smiling at Barker. I've had a number of private conversations with your wife and find the same is true. I know behind closed doors you listen intently to what Louise has to say. Times are changing, and we need to embrace that change if we are to be the party that represents all people. Barker laughed. You got me there. He raised his glass in a salute. Now, if you'll excuse me, I see more people have arrived. You know where the bar is. When Barker was out of earshot, Nicole gave Jenkins an appreciative glance, acknowledging him for defending her. Thank you, she said. Are you feeling all right? Jenkins inquired. Yes, why? I was expecting you to answer first. It's not like you backed down from a fight. I guess I'm not up for it this evening. My mind went back to a party a few weeks ago and how Louise led me away from a conversation when I started to voice my opinion. Nicole gave a crooked frown. I choose my battles more carefully, I suppose. Just remember your feistiness is what attracted me to you, Jenkins said. Nicole smiled at him just as two senators' wives walked up to her. Jenkins smiled back, excused himself, leaving Nicole as he was called over to join Barker and Senator Daniel Mercer, who were deep in conversation. What happens to be on the minds of you two, gentlemen? Jenkins inquired as he joined him. Senator Mercer was the first to speak. Larry and I were wondering how the investigation into the assassination is going. Is there any chance that you'll be able to make some kind of announcement in the coming weeks? We are still investigating some leads. I'm not very comfortable with announcing anything until I have a few more facts confirmed. Jenkins was stalling. The sooner we can put this behind us, the better, Bobby, Barker replied. This is an election year, and we need to focus on the congressional races and, of course, the White House. If there is some evidence that can help our chances, then we need to use that to our advantage. The party has to decide and put its collective weight behind a frontrunner. I understand your concerns. I want to have another look at where we stand before I commit one way or the other. Jenkins's mind was churning. The internal battle of whether to show Barker and Mercer the Sipes confession tape began again. He needed to sit down and determine the pros and cons of any action he would take. He needed to make this decision, but not without some careful thought and confirmation. Have you given any more thought to our suggestion about declaring your candidacy? Barker asked. If there is an indication that some committee hearing on the assassination aren't needed, that would be a perfect avenue to show your leadership. I have been considering it, Jenkins answered. I was thinking of throwing my hat in the ring, if only for the experience of running a presidential campaign. Good, Barker said, turning to smile at Mercer. I think we need to confirm your candidacy quickly. The Iowa caucus is crucial and only 20 days away. I took the liberty of drawing up the necessary documents after our last discussion. I think you need to call a press conference tomorrow, Bobby, to make it official, Mercer added. We'll be happy to stand by your side. Jenkins swallowed. He understood the importance of the Iowa caucus, and he had led the press to believe that he would officially declare after the holidays. He wasn't sure he liked the fact that Barker had taken liberties. He had not discussed a presidential run with Nicole, and he wasn't sure what her reaction would be. I suppose the sooner the better, he said. Yes, Mercer responded. Have Chris call the press together at 1 o'clock tomorrow. We'll announce on Capitol Hill. Jenkins smiled and nodded his agreement, making a mental note to call his aide, Chris, in the morning. Jenkins snatched a quick glance to see Nicole sitting at the fortune teller's table. And you know that Nikki would make a wonderful first lady, Mercer finished. Jenkins realized he hadn't heard a word Mercer had said. There was an awkward silence in the air when Jenkins turned his head to see both Barker and Mercer staring at him on the verge of laughing. "I'm sorry, gentlemen. I didn't hear what you said." Barker took the initiative this time. Daniel was commenting how Nikki would make a wonderful first lady. Jenkins began to blush slightly as he again looked over in Nicole's direction. "I believe we're a bit far away from that happening. Excuse me, I'd like to get something to drink." Jenkins walked past Nicole on his way to the bar. "This is Nikki," one woman said. "She says she doesn't believe in this stuff." "I have many who don't believe at first," the fortune teller answered, smiling at Nicole. She looked at the two women escorts and said, "If you will excuse us, I will do Nikki's reading now." The two women walked a short distance away. The fortune teller looked at Nicole, smiled again, and said, "You have a number of people here who want to talk to you." Nicole gave a brief chuckle. "Really? I kind of doubt that." "You have a lot of doubt, but you never used to be that way." The fortune teller, who was more of a medium than a predictor of the future, picked up one of her tarot decks. She began to shuffle the cards. She set down the deck and picked up a pen and paper. Reaching over, she grabbed a business card and handed it to Nicole. "This has some information about me in case you ever want to get in touch with me again. What was your full name at birth?" "Nicole Ray Charbonneau. Ray spelled R-A-E. The fortune teller asked her to spell her last name. She asked for Nicole's birthday. Nicole watched the fortune teller write down numbers and add them together. She decided she was doing some kind of numerology. "You are a hierophant, which is a counselor," the fortune teller declared. "What do you do for a living?" "Guess," Nicole answered snidely. "I read cards and listen to my guides. I don't read minds," the fortune teller replied. Her tone was becoming a bit more serious. "I'm a lawyer, but not sure I want to go back to that profession," Nicole answered, resigned to the fact that answering sarcastically would only prolong the experience. The fortune teller smiled. She picked up another deck and shuffled it. Returning to the first deck, she commented, "You have a number of people watching over you. Your parents are on the other side." The fortune teller was still shuffling her cards. "They are proud of what you have achieved, and especially with something that has just occurred or ended." Nicole's brow furrowed as she listened to the fortune teller. "Did someone tell you what happened?" "No, I'm just passing a message on to you, but your parents have passed some time ago." "This was in some kind of accident?" Nicole sat back. She scanned the room. No one in the room knew how Nicole's parents had passed. "Okay, I'll give you that one." "Give me that one? I'm not sure I understand." "No one here knows how my parents died, or when, for that matter." The fortune teller smiled. She didn't feel a need to convince Nicole that she was a true medium. She had had her share of non-believers in the room this evening. She decided to move on with the reading. She removed the Hierophant card and laid it on the table between them. She covered the card with two cards. The Eight of Swords and the Two of Pentacles were now facing Nicole. "There is something to which you are blind. There is something of importance that is being kept from you." Nicole looked at the cards and then at the fortune teller. "By who?" The fortune teller pulled the Two of Cups. "It's someone close to you. It is someone who you have been with as a friend or a lover. Considering I'm dating a senator, there are probably a lot of things he is keeping from me. As for my friends, my closest friend was killed. I don't have many friends." The fortune teller paused for a minute. "Carol wants to say hello." Nicole was shocked. She turned pale at the mention of her best friend's name. "That's not funny." "I didn't intend it to be funny. She wanted to make sure that you knew she was here. She just spoke to me when you said you don't have many friends." "Who told you about Carol?" Nicole demanded. "No one told me." The fortune teller looked at Nicole. "Carol really wants you to know that she appreciated that you were by her side when she passed." Nicole was still pale and in shock. "And she is laughing now because of the look on your face. I take it Carol was a bit of a prankster in life?" "Yes, you might say that," Nicole said. "Is she okay?" "She's fine. You being there when she passed helped her. She felt your love for her. She was watching over you." The fortune teller placed the Four of Cups on the table. "You are to be given a gift." She pulled two more cards and laid them next to the Four of Cups. The first card was the Seven of Swords. The other was the devil card. She watched Nicole as she started to retreat from the cards, both of which seemed ominous to her. The fortune teller put her fingers on the seven of swords. This card is indicating that there may be some kind of betrayal associated with the gift. The devil card represents hopes and fears in either direction. I don't understand, Nicole said, leaning forward. Can you tell me what the gift is? Is it something bad? The fortune teller shuffled the deck a few more times. She pulled the hermit card and laid it on top of the other three cards. She took the four of cups and placed it directly below the hermit card. There will be a need for an investigation. During this investigation, you will see someone close to you in a different light. A side of him or her will be exposed. The fortune teller then drew two more cards from the deck. It was the Queen of Wands, followed by the Temperance card. She laid them on top of the spread. A lot depends on the decision that someone close to you needs to make. If this person decides in a way that you can't abide by, you will need to escape. You'll feel trapped and feel a need to get away. You can't tell me who this person is? Nicole almost sounded desperate. The fortune teller sat for a minute, concentrating and asking her guides for assistance. She shuffled the cards once more until she came upon the card she was directed to pull from the deck. She laid the card on the table. Nicole looked at the card and needed no explanation. She immediately stood and walked away from the table. The fortune teller had placed the lover's card on that table. Nicole briskly walked out of the room and headed for the bathroom. She needed a few minutes to compose herself alone. She locked the door behind her and stood with the palms of her hand bracing on each side of the sink. She realized that she was breathing hard, extremely hard. She began to feel lightheaded. She was about to hyperventilate. She sat down on the toilet. Why am I feeling this way? She whispered. You don't believe in this stuff. Why do I feel like I've been stabbed? I can't breathe. She rested her elbows on her thighs as the adrenaline continued to surge. Just breathe. She started to slow her breathing, resisting the urge to take short breaths. She held her breath, counting to five, then letting it go. With each breath, she counted a little longer, first to seven, then 10. She started to breathe normally. She sat up and then stood, regaining her composure. She ran cold water over her hands and taking her right hand and putting it on the back of her neck. There was a knock on the door. It was a gentle little knock showing no urgency. Nikki? A southern voice said softly with a hint of concern. Are you all right? Is there something wrong? It was Jenkins. He had witnessed her rapidly paced exit from the room and excused himself from the conversation with another guest to check on her. Nikki looked in the mirror. Her eyes were wide with fear, and she shook her head and whispered, Quit this. Quit being stupid. What? I didn't hear you, Jenkins said, straining from the other side of the door and answering quietly, trying not to draw attention. Nikki? The door to the bathroom opened. Jenkins saw a pale Nicole standing before him. You're as white as a ghost, he said. He took her gently by the arm and led her to Senator Barker's study, shutting the door behind them. What happened? I saw you quickly leaving the room. Are you feeling all right? Nicole sat down in the chair closest to her. Yes, I'm fine. Something the fortune teller said upset me, but I'm okay. She tried to smile. What did she say? It makes perfect sense now that when I think about it. I just had a moment of fear or something. Maybe I haven't recovered fully from everything that happened. Nicole stood, but lost her balance a little. Jenkins moved quickly to her side and helped her back to sit back down. I think we better head home. You stay here. I'll give our regrets to Barker and retrieve our coats. No, don't do that. I'm fine. No, you need to rest. I'll be back. Jenkins left the room, closing the door behind him quickly. He found Louise and she went to retrieve their coats. He apologized to Senator Barker as well. He met Louise outside the study, where she handed Jenkins their coats as he entered the study. Peering over Jenkins' shoulder, Louise asked, Nikki, what happened? Just some kind of bug, I guess, Nikki answered. Jenkins set the coats down to help Nikki to her feet. She turned to get Nicole's coat and held it open while she put it on. He quickly put his coat on and offered his arm to Nicole. Please tell Senator Barker that I'm sorry to take Bobby away from the party, she said. I will tell the senator you weren't feeling well. He'll understand. Don't give it another thought. Louise watched Jenkins. She admired the way he cared for Nicole. She remembered fondly the days when her husband acted in such a same manner. She longed for those days again. The years of disagreements had taken their tolls. She wondered if Jenkins and Nicole would survive all that laid ahead of them, the good and the bad. I hope you feel better, Nikki. If there's anything I can do, please call me, she added. That's very kind of you. I'll be fine. I just need to lie down, I think. She placed one arm under Bobby's offered arm, moving her hand to rest on his hand. She looked at Jenkins and smiled. Thank you both for your concern. It must just be the flu or something. Thank you again, Jenkins said as they started down the hall. Happy New Year to you and Senator Barker, he said as he reached the front door. The same to both of you, Louise said as she opened the door. She watched them get into Jenkins' car before returning to the party. As Jenkins drove away from Barker's home, he waited patiently for Nicole to speak. Nicole, however, was in no hurry to talk about the reading. She calmly looked out the window, silently wondering just what the reading meant. Jenkins ran out of patience and finally asked, "Will you please tell me exactly what happened?" Nicole turned her head and looked at Jenkins. "It's nothing, Bobby." Jenkins gave her a quick glance, a glance which Nicole was becoming very familiar with and received when Jenkins wasn't very happy with her. "It was something the fortune teller said. I didn't want the fortune teller to read me. I don't know what she knew about some things." "What things?" "She knew my parents died in an accident. She knew about Carol. She guessed I had been through some ordeal, and my parents were proud of how I handled it. She said that Carol was glad I was with her when she passed, that my love for her helped her pass." Nicole looked at Bobby. "How did she know all this? Have you told anyone about..." "How could I have told someone about your parents? I didn't know anything about that. In fact, you never mentioned your parents. As for Carol, her death was in the newspaper." "It was also strange," Nikki replied. "I still don't understand why this upsets you so much." "That wasn't what upset me. And the most upsetting thing was her telling me that someone close to me may betray me, that they are withholding information from me." "And that person is me?" Jenkins asked. The hurt was evident in his voice. "It could be," Nicole answered. "I know you can't tell me everything, Bobby." "No, I can't," he confirmed. "I'm on the Intelligence Committee, for one thing. I can't share everything with you. There will always be a portion of my service I can't share. I thought you understood that." "I do. I know I'm being silly," Nicole paused. A part of her didn't want to continue. "But she indicated whatever you're withholding will hurt me in some way." "What?" Jenkins yelled back. "I would never intentionally hurt you." "I know, but I can't get this out of my head. Well, unless you can tell me what it is that I'm supposed to be keeping from you, I can't help you," Jenkins said, clearly frustrated. "It has to do with a gift of some kind." "Now that makes no sense to me at all. Any gift I give you would not hurt you." Jenkins was getting more and more agitated. "I know, I'm sorry. Can we just forget about it? It all seems so silly now." Jenkins sat quietly and then decided it was probably better to tell Nicole about the conversation he had discussed with Barker and Mercer. "Nikki, there is one thing I do need to tell you." Nikki's heart started to beat faster. She couldn't imagine what Jenkins was going to tell her, and there was a part of her that didn't want to know. With reserve evidence in her voice, she said, "Yes." Jenkins hesitated a moment when he heard her tone. "Barker and Mercer approached me a few weeks ago. They want me to consider running for president. Of course, I would be one of many candidates, but with Barker and Mercer behind me, it is something I have to consider." Nicole was relieved it wasn't a proposal of marriage. "I think that's great, Bobby. You should run." "You think so?" Jenkins responded. "They seem to think the time is right. I think it provides experience in running a presidential campaign. I doubt I'll get the nomination." "I think you're underestimating yourself," Nicole said. "I think this just might work out for you." Jenkins smiled. "We'll make the announcement tomorrow at 1. Can you be there with me?" "Absolutely," Nicole replied. "I wouldn't miss it." Okay, so that's the end of chapter 1, part 2. with Bobby and Nicole and the being at the New Year's party with the fortune teller. So hope you enjoyed the reading. We have chapter one, part three coming up, and that also has to do with a New Year's party at a different part of Washington. And there's part four that'll be up after that, which basically deals with Jenkins's announcement. So the next couple chapters or parts of chapter one take place in Washington, D.C. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening and enjoying the. I hope you enjoyed the reading, and I hope that you will pass these on to friends. Thanks, everyone. See you next time. Blind Persuasion, Chapter 1, Part 3. Meanwhile, at the White House, President Stevens was having a small gathering of close friends to celebrate New Year's Day, watching football games as the wives chatted about upcoming events. It was one day that Stevens didn't want to be president. Being president and trying to honor his predecessor's plan was excruciatingly painful. Many of Andrews's policies were counter to his own. He couldn't wait to be his own man again and end the charade he was playing. Stevens was waiting for one more of his friends to arrive. He was really hoping that Tony would show up with Nicole on his arm. Stevens had seen the tabloid photos that proclaimed the most eligible bachelor on Capitol Hill was off the market. He had witnessed the state dinners with Nicole on Senator Jenkins's arm. Stevens never liked Jenkins, and he was not happy about their relationship. He wanted to talk to his old friend and confidant, Tony, to see if there was some way to get Nicole away from the Southern Snake. Since the death of Norman Sipes, Stevens had seen very little of Tony. Having called Tony a few hours earlier and finding himself still waiting, he was beginning to wonder if he would have to call Tony again. Just as he was getting up to do so, the butler opened the door to the room and in walked the sun-bleached, white-haired, debonair Tony. "Where have you been?" Stevens asked as he walked over to shake his friend's hand. "On my yacht," Tony answered, grasping Stevens' offered hand. "Grab yourself a drink and join us. We're watching the Rose Bowl." Stevens walked back over to his seat while Tony poured himself a drink at the wet bar. "Now that I have you all here, I want to talk to you." "Joe?" Stevens said as he sat down across from Wall Street financier Joseph Engel. Stevens and Engel had been friends for decades. Engel was now handling Stevens' investments while he was vice president and president and was treasurer of every political office for which Stevens campaigned. "I think you should take over Sipes' company and prepare to drill for oil in Anwar. The bill is due, Mr. President," Tony interjected. "I don't think it's proper for you to discuss." "That's bullshit," Stevens interrupted. "It's just us talking during a football game." "I beg your pardon, Mr. President," Tony said, setting his drink down on the table in front of him. He stood up. "But quite frankly, I'm tired of covering all your asses." "Tony, we need your help on this," Engel said. "Count me out," Tony replied. "Then assign Nikki to this," Stevens said. He was hoping it would provide an opportunity to see her. "No," Tony responded. "Why do you need help?" "Sipes' estate hasn't been settled yet. A reading of his will is in order," Engel answered. "So?" Tony questioned. He was not sure why the reading was necessary. "We don't know what's to become of Sipes Oil Company. And as an investor, I want to know what happens to the company," Engel stated. Tony looked at Engel astonished. He then started to chuckle, which turned into a loud, hearty laugh. "Are you serious?" he managed to get out. "The man was flat broke. He owed money on his house, car, you name it. Any assets the company will have will be used to pay off his debts." "For Christ's sake, Engel, I thought you out of everyone here would be able to figure that one out." "I still want to have his will read. I think as investors, we have a right to petition for that." Tony scanned the room. FBI directors Jeffrey, Stevens, their wives became silent during Tony's rant. Every eye was now on him, waiting for an answer. Sipes didn't have any surviving family members. It is in probate. I'll check on the status when I get back to the office in a few days. He started for the door. Tony, where are you going? Stay here. Watch the game with us, Stevens called. I'd rather not be present when you talk about things that you shouldn't be talking about, Mr. President. I just don't care enough to be interested. Tony forced a smile and added, Happy New Year, sir. With that, he turned and walked out of the room. What's up with him? Engel asked. I have no idea, Stevens replied. Blind Persuasion, Chapter 1, Part 4. Jenkins called Chris at home, waking him up early and giving him instructions to organize a press conference on Capitol Hill. Jenkins knew this was just a formality, but it still felt rushed. He jumped in the shower and then quickly got dressed. He walked down the stairs to the kitchen where Nicole was standing, drinking a cup of tea and staring out the window. She had on a stunning forest green dress, conservative in style, yet daring enough to reveal her voluptuous figure. Jenkins stood a moment, taking in her ravishing beauty and mentally slipping the dress off her shoulders, exposing her sensuous body underneath. Good morning, Nikki greeted him, knowing exactly what he was doing. Jenkins smiled, but did not blush at being caught in the act of undressing her in his mind. Good morning. He walked up to her, took her in his arms, and kissed her. Chris called when you were in the shower. He said, everything's ready. You have your speech? Nicole asked. Jenkins poured himself a cup of coffee. Yes, I do. He patted the coat where his breast pocket was located. President Robert Jenkins. President Jenkins. Nicole was speaking his name out loud as if testing to see how it sounded. President Bobby Jenkins. Enough, Jenkins exclaimed with a hint of laughter in his voice. I'm nervous enough as it is. He enjoyed when she teased him. You look marvelous in that dress. I thought you might like a bit of a distraction. We better be going, Jenkins said. Barker has some people dropping by that he wants us to meet. People? Nicole questioned. She took the last sip of her tea and followed him out of the room to the foyer. Yes, my campaign manager and treasurer. Oh, Bobby, Nicole started. He's not letting you choose your campaign manager? We talked about this a few weeks ago. He gave me a choice. Nicole frowned as Jenkins helped her into her coat. Nikki, it's the way Barker is. There's no sense arguing with him. Besides, we both know I don't stand a chance of getting the numbers I need in Iowa. Nicole became irritated. That's enough of that talk. You will get the numbers you need, and you know it. The drive over to the Capitol was a pleasant one. Congress was still on break, so there was less traffic and plenty of parking. Upon arriving, Jenkins retreated to his office where he began to study and then practice his speech. Chris was busy fielding calls from the press and from Senator Barker's office to coordinate meetings with Jenkins. Nicole volunteered to head down to the area where the press would be gathering to make sure everything was ready. She returned shortly before noon and reported that all was indeed ready, and she even tested the microphones with the staff who were setting up the room. A few minutes later, Barker walked into Jenkins's outer office with two gentlemen. He greeted everyone in the room and told Chris he was ready to meet with Jenkins. Chris excused himself and walked into Jenkins's inner sanctuary to announce their arrival. Nicole admired Chris's loyalty. He never let the stature of a person waiting to meet with Jenkins intimidate him. Hello, Nikki, Barker started. I'd like you to meet Nelson Keaton, James Carlson. The two men walked over, meeting Nicole halfway. She extended her hand to shake theirs. It's nice to meet you. Nicole greeted each one who respectively returned the sentiment. Barker finished the introduction. Nelson will be Bobby's campaign treasurer. Jimmy will be his campaign manager. Of course, Mr. Carson, now I recognize your name, Nicole replied. We're honored to have you on board. Carson gave Nicole an odd look. He turned and looked at Barker with confusion. Barker smiled. Nikki is Bobby's fiance. No, I'm just a good friend, Nicole corrected him. Well, that won't do, Carson retorted. The most eligible bachelor on Capitol Hill needs to show the American people that he is in a serious relationship now. So either you are his fiance or a friend who isn't part of his inner circle. The door to Jenkins's office opened. Chris noticed the stare down between Carson and Nicole. You can go in now. If that is the choice you are giving me, Mr. Carson, then allow me to reintroduce myself. I'm Nicole Charbonneau, counsel to Senator Robert Jenkins. I'm sure you're all aware of my firm, Rosen, Schaefer, and Pruitt. With that, Nicole walked past Chris, giving him a smile and a wink. Chris wasn't sure what exactly happened, but he knew Nicole just upped the stakes in the conversation. Carson looked at Barker, then at Keaton. The three men walked into Jenkins's office. Barker made the introductions and Jenkins shook everyone's hand. Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's an honor to have you on my campaign, Mr. Carson. Call me Jim or Jimmy, Carson said. I'd like you to understand that you are really 6 weeks behind everyone else, and the Iowa caucus is a short 3 weeks away. You need to give the appearance from the start that you are serious and that you are ready. I've taken the liberty of starting up your campaign staff in Iowa, New Hampshire, Minnesota, and in Maine. Jenkins was shocked that this was moving so quickly. I see, he said. He didn't like that Barker was so entrenched in his campaign, and he was beginning to feel a bit smothered. He looked at Nicole. She smiled, then sat down in the chair off to the side. The others took her cue and sat down. Chris started to exit and close the door. Just a minute, Chris. I need you to take some notes. Chris will need the phone numbers for each of you in the campaign offices. I'll have an aide from my office dispatch immediately to get all the information Chris needs, Carson replied, dismissing Chris with a wave of the hand. Chris didn't move, and Jenkins didn't like Carson ordering his aide around. Jenkins motioned him into the office and handed him the legal pad and pen. Have a seat, Chris, and if you'd be so kind as to take some notes for me. It'll be my pleasure, sir, Chris replied as he took the items from Jenkins. He looked at Nicole and smiled, beginning to understand what he had witnessed between Carson and Nicole. He sat down off to the senator's other side. Nicole noticed how the people Jenkins could trust the most now flanked him. There was an awkward silence in the room. No one was really sure who was going to talk or what they wanted to say. Nicole was trying her hardest to mentally nudge Jenkins to take control. She wondered if anyone heard her expel the breath she was holding when Jenkins finally did speak. Mr. Carson, I appreciate all you have done to get this campaign off to a rousing start, being, as you said, 6 weeks or more behind. However, I will not allow mistakes to occur in all haste. That may be determined as taking a different stand on an issue, for example, in the near future. I trust you haven't made any policy statements for me that I don't know about or that I couldn't possibly embrace. I made no such public statements. I wouldn't do that until we had a chance to meet and discuss what your stances are and what our campaign is about. We need to do that this afternoon, Senator. Carson paused, then added, alone, without your counsel present? My counsel? Jenkins questioned. Ms. Charbonneau, Carson answered. Jenkins looked at Nicole, his eyebrows furrowed in confusion. Nicole smiled at his confusion. Allow me to explain, Carson started. I think I'd rather hear from Nikki, if you don't mind, Jenkins stated without taking his eyes off of her. Nicole was grateful for Jenkins' authoritative response. She smiled and said, it was a necessary action, Senator. You see, Mr. Carson wants me to be your fiancé, or I will not be included in your campaign or discussions. In light of that decision, I took the liberty of becoming your counsel on behalf of Rosen, Schaefer, and Pruitt. Jenkins held his gaze at Nicole for a few seconds. Nicole could tell that Jenkins was angry. He slowly turned his head, first looking at Barker, then at Carson. Nikki is not my fiancé, and we will not be put on show for the public. When and if I ask Nikki to marry me, she will be the first to be asked. Our relationship is very strong, but it is also very young. Senator Barker, Mr. Carson, I will not allow either of you to manipulate our relationship in any fashion. Is that understood? Are you sleeping together? Carson asked. That is none of your business, Mr. Carson, Jenkins shot back. Oh, believe me, Senator, if the people of this country find out that you two are shacking up, it will become my business. Jenkins was fuming. His brown eyes flashed the anger, and his facial expression also revealed it. He gritted his teeth as he formulated his response. When he spoke, he enunciated every word, taking great energy to show the anger and assertion behind each one. My personal life is not and will not be a pivotal part of this campaign. If you cannot convince yourself that your answer upon receiving any questions is that it is none of anyone's business, then I'm afraid we will have to part ways now. Bobby, Barker jumped in quickly. I think there's a bit of an overreaction here. If Nikki wants to be your lawyer, then let her be your lawyer. It answers a lot of questions conveniently. Nicole chuckled. So you don't see it as a problem when the press finds out that Senator Jenkins, a candidate for president, is discovered shacking up with his lawyer? Jenkins lowered his head, trying to keep himself from laughing. Because frankly, gentlemen, I think that the bar would find that a bit disturbing. So, just to be clear and determine, if you are to stay my campaign manager, Mr. Carson, Nikki is not my lawyer. Nikki and I are in a relationship. She currently is not my fiancé and will not be my fiancé until a time upon which I ask her to marry me. Jenkins looked at Carson. You realize this could sink us, Carson answered. If you think that my relationship with Nikki is the biggest problem this campaign will have, then I believe it is better you leave now. Jenkins' voice was clearly calm but furious. Do I need to remind you that Iran and Iraq are about to go to war? The Soviet Union has just invaded Afghanistan? There are Americans being held hostage in Iran, and that's the tip of the iceberg? Our economy is in a deep recession, and I don't think my Republican counterparts have the correct answers to stop this plunge. Our first campaign stop is Iowa, an agricultural state whose farmers who have been hit hard by the declining exports, crop prices declining, and interest rates rising, the sharp rise in oil prices, and fears that we may be going into another oil crisis and has Americans in a panic. Jenkins looked at Carson. And you're worried about our relationship being the biggest issue of my campaign? Carson looked at Jenkins. If you can answer every question about your relationship with the same conviction you just showed me, then I'm not concerned about this relationship. Jenkins smiled. Let's get to work then. We only have 25 minutes until my press conference. Jenkins looked down at the papers that contained his announcement speech. He picked up the pen and began writing some notes in the margin. He looked up and announced, I wasn't planning on saying much at the conference or taking any questions. I think we should keep it short and sweet with an invitation to join us in Iowa. What's our first stop? That depends on our strategy. Are you going to just focus on the urban areas? Should we focus on college towns? You are young, and that will be an appeal to college students. Do we ignore the farm towns, which typically caucus for Republicans? Why would you ignore anyone? Nicole asked. Because we only have 3 weeks to ensure that Bobby becomes a viable candidate, Carson answered. The caucus process is different. It's not a vote. For Jenkins to be a viable candidate and receive a media endorsement on January 21st, he will need to have at least 15% of the attendees backing him, as in literally standing under his banner when the evening is through. If he has the highest percentage, the press will then officially dub him a frontrunner. So you need a strategy that will ensure that Bobby gets to the 15% consistently, Nicole stated. My preference is to hit the urban areas and college towns. I can stop at the agricultural towns in between, Jenkins said. That would be my best counsel, Carson replied. He looked at Keaton. Nelson, we need to generate some cash fast, some endorsements. He looked at Barker when he mentioned the endorsements. I'll start lobbying some PACs now. Nelson stood up and started for the door. Barker was thinking, I have a few friends that I can call tonight. I'm sure we could wrestle up some endorsements by the weekend. Barker stood up. I'll let you alone to work out the details of the campaign. I'll see you in the conference room in about 15 minutes. Carson, Jenkins, Nicole, and Chris started to discuss the campaign strategy. Nicole listened without contributing much. This position was her preference. This race to the White House was Jenkins's to win or lose. Jenkins was writing notes, scratching out sentences on his speech. With 5 minutes until the announcement, Jenkins stood up, gathering his notes, and everyone started out the door to the conference room. Jenkins held Nicole's hand as they walked into the room. His notes were in a leather folder that he carried in his other hand. Jenkins was quiet, and Nicole took notice of him caressing her hand with his thumb. She could tell he was nervous. "Want some advice?" Nicole said quietly. "I'm not sure," Jenkins replied, wondering what Nicole might have to say. "Just be yourself. Say what Bobby Jenkins would say, not what Barker or Carson or Mercer would say. When you stray from your truth, that is when it will trip you up." Jenkins smiled at her. "You didn't get to the Senate on Barker's or Mercer's coattails. The people of North Carolina saw your vision. The country needs to see your vision now. So make sure it is always your voice they hear, your decisions, your thoughts. Do that, and you'll be a lot happier in the long run." They reached the conference room. Mercer and Barker were waiting. Mercer shook Jenkins' hands. "It's an exciting day, Bobby." He turned and looked at Nicole and gave her a quick hug. He smiled and said to Jenkins, "I can't tell you how pleased I am that I'm going to introduce you today. Shall we?" Mercer walked through the door to the stage, followed by Jenkins, who was still holding Nicole's hand. Carson, Chris, and Barker followed behind. "Good afternoon," Mercer started, standing at the podium. "I have witnessed a number of senators and representatives come and go in my long career, but I have never witnessed a senator with the intelligence and quickness that I have seen in Senator Robert Jenkins. His career in the military, albeit brief, was honorable. His experience stirred his desire to continue to serve his country and led him here to Washington, D.C. He has written many bills, and I have witnessed his negotiating skills and his ability to reach across the aisle to find common ground over and over again. Quite frankly, this young lad impressed me from our first meeting. I'm proud to introduce Senator Jenkins today and to say to you that the Democratic Party is proud to have him run for president." Mercer turned to shake Jenkins' hands. The flash bulbs from the press were blinding. Nicole wanted to shield her eyes, as did everyone else on the stage, but all resisted. Mercer motioned to the podium, and Jenkins walked up to it. Opening his leather folder, he paged through his speech. "Thank you all for coming this afternoon. You are probably wondering why I'm throwing my hat in the ring now. It is not entirely a new concept, my running for president. I think every talk show has hinted that I had interest. Well, today, I am officially announcing my campaign for President of the United States. I'd like to thank Senator Mercer, Senator Barker, for their great counsel and support while I thought through what this really means and why I feel I'm the best candidate for the job. My country faces many challenges, both foreign and domestic. There is a need for strong leadership, and I am very grateful to my fellow senators and representatives for their vote of confidence in my ability to lead. I'd like to take this opportunity to announce that Mr. James Carson will be my campaign manager, Mr. Nelson Keaton will be my treasurer. Someone told me you have to make that announcement for it to be official." There was a laughter from the press and from those on stage. Jenkins smiled, appreciative that the press got the joke. "We are gearing up for the Iowa caucus, which is just around the corner. So without any more fanfare, I'll be boarding a plane to Iowa this evening with Jim Carson to join our supporters to kick this campaign off and hit the ground running. Thank you again for coming. We'll see you in Des Moines tomorrow." More flash bulbs went off, and Jenkins gave a smile and wave. Mercer, Barker, and Carson moved forward. Nicole stood back and was thankful not to be at the front. There were some strategically placed supporters in the room who were clapping and cheering. Chris disappeared off the stage and pulled a string that released a cascade of confetti and balloons. The sign behind Jenkins was revealed, showing a red, white, and blue design with stars and stripes. It read, "Jenkins for President." Nicole clapped and smiled. She watched Jenkins soak up the shining moment. Jenkins turned his head and saw that she wasn't beside him. He reached back, took her hand, and brought her forward for another set of pictures. This went on for a few minutes until Carson ushered them off the stage. Just before leaving it, Carson grabbed the microphone. "See you in Iowa," he exclaimed. Everyone joyously walked back to Jenkins's office. Mercer and Barker shook Jenkins' hand again and excused themselves to start the business of gathering endorsements. They worked out how they would coordinate their schedules. Carson would be the point person. He would also work with Chris on the senator's schedule back in Washington. There were some key votes coming up, and Jenkins needed to make a stand. That meant flying back to Washington to give some perfectly timed speeches. "I'm not kidding, Bobby. The plane leaves tonight for Des Moines. You got 2 hours before you have to be at the airport," Carson said as he walked out of the office. Chris walked in and handed his ticket to Jenkins, then turned to hand Nicole her ticket. "What's this?" Nicole asked. "It's your ticket," Chris answered. "Carson insisted on sitting next to you, sir. Nikki is across the aisle." "I'm not going to Iowa tonight," Nicole stated. "I have a meeting scheduled at the firm tomorrow, then lunch with Tony on his yacht. Can't you postpone that?" He closed the folder and threw it into his briefcase. "No," Nikki said, shaking her head. "Bobby, this is your thing. I made this appointment with Tony over 2 weeks ago. I don't know when he's going to be back in his office again. He seems to be spending more and more time on his yacht. I want to get this over with. I've got a feeling that he's planning on retiring now that I won't be with the firm any longer." "I see," Jenkins said dejectedly. "You'll fly to Iowa after that? You'll join me there?" Nicole handed her ticket back to Chris. "I'm not sure what day, but we'll talk on the phone. Remember, I'm not the important one here. You're the one running for president." Jenkins closed his briefcase, walked over to her with her coat in his hands. He opened the coat. "Yes, but if you play your cards right, you might be the first lady." Nicole paused. She turned and looked at Jenkins. He could tell he wasn't really going to like what she had to say. "It was a joke. Really, I was joking." "No, you weren't," Nicole said. "Don't even go there. Don't even speak like that to the press. Don't even hint at it." Jenkins looked confused. "It's too soon, Bobby. It's entirely too soon." Jenkins knew she was right. So many things had happened so quickly in the last few months. She had barely got her feet back on the ground when this announcement hit. She needed time, and that was the one thing Jenkins could give her. "Will you do me one favor?" Nicole asked as they walked out of Jenkins' office. "Anything." She smiled at how he always wanted to please her. "Don't just accept the party line on things. Stay true to your convictions. Don't change fighting for what's right because you want to be president so badly. Be the change, Bobby, which you have always wanted to be. This election is so important, and we both know we are at a crossroads here. I admire your stances on so many issues. Don't let them manipulate you. If you lose because of big money or lack of support from voters, then it is what it is, but at least you were true to yourself." Jenkins smiled at her naivety. Politics was a world of compromise. If he truly wanted to be elected, he knew he was going to have to compromise, and he was going to have to stroke the egos of big money. "I can only do my best." It was the only answer he could give her. "With you by my side, maybe I can be that strong presence that you think I am." Chapter 1, Part 5. The next morning, Nicole talked with Jenkins over the phone. Jenkins informed her of strategy decisions, and Nicole offered her advice before she left for her appointment at the law firm. She was nervous, but she was determined to get what she deserved. She had it all worked out, and in an earlier conversation with Tony, she had made it clear that she expected no problems with the other partners in terms of compensation. Tony promised her that she would get what she wanted at the minimum. As she walked to Tony's yacht, carrying a small paper bag containing some bakery bread, assorted cheeses, and a bottle of white wine, she reflected on the meeting. The meeting itself was a difficult negotiation. She never cared for Rosen. She now understood how Tony protected her from the wrath of the other two partners. Pruitt was more level-headed and in the end realized it was best to be generous with their offer. She was quite pleased with the outcome. Tony spotted Nicole and waved. She smiled and quickened her pace to the yacht, stopping just before stepping on the boat. "Permission to come aboard, Captain?" she jokingly asked. "Permission granted," Tony gladly said. Nicole walked onto the yacht via a little gangway bridge. Tony offered his hand to help her on board. They gave each other a hug, made awkward by the bag of groceries coming between them. Tony took the bag out of Nicole's hands as they moved inside to the covered and heated living area of the yacht. They entered the cabin, which was nicely decorated and very comfortable. Tony walked to the galley with the bag of food and began to unload it. "Thanks for stopping for this." He took out the bottle of wine and put it in the little refrigerator. "I want to chill this for a few minutes. How'd the meeting go?" Nicole knew he didn't want all the details. He was only interested in the amount of money she had negotiated. "I would say it went very well. They offered a little over $800,000 and I settled for $1 million. "Woohoo!" Tony exclaimed through a huge grin. "Congratulations!" Nicole smiled as Tony walked over to her to give her another hug. They held the embrace for a moment. Tony softly said, "I'm so proud of you, Nikki." Nicole truly missed Tony, though they had their differences through the years. She never realized until this moment how much he had protected her and helped her with her career. There were not many women in her field who could have accomplished the things she had accomplished without the help of a male mentor championing her. "Thank you, Tony. Thank you for all your help." She pulled away to look at him. Tony understood why she was thanking him. "It was my pleasure. You were smart and one hell of a lawyer. The firm was extremely lucky to have you. I just wish I hadn't pushed all those horrible cases on you. If I could do it over, I would have assigned a number of those cases to someone else." "It's over now. Let's put it behind us." Nicole took a deep breath. "That chowder smells wonderful." She took her coat off and laid it on the corner of the leather couch. "Is it about ready? I'm starving." She moved to the galley. The galley sitting area and dining area were all open, a perfect setup for the bachelor standing before her. Tony retrieved the bottle from the fridge, opened it, and poured her a glass of white wine. "It's just about ready," he answered, handing her the glass. "I'll slice some bread while we wait." He took out the cutting board and a bowl. He began slicing the baguette and tossing the pieces into it. He then handed Nicole a plate and a cheese slicer. "If you would like to arrange the cheeses," he said. Nicole took a drink of her wine and began the task given to her. She allowed the wine to warm her. She took another sip just as Tony returned from placing the bread on the table. "Are you feeling okay?" Tony asked. "It was harder than I thought to walk into that firm. I don't think that person exists anymore. So many things have happened, and I don't think I'll ever be the same," Nicole explained. "I'm not sure I have the strength I used to have." Nicole paused a moment. "I really miss Carol. Being in the office brought back so many memories." Nicole looked down. Whenever she thought of Carol, her heart ached. "We've certainly lost a lot of friends this past year." "Amen to that," Nicole said as she raised her glass. Tony brought his glass to hers, producing a little clink when the crystal glasses touched. They simultaneously took a drink. "This is the first time we've seen each other since you disappeared after Carol's murder. What happened to you?" Tony asked as he stirred the soup. "Oh gosh, that's a long story," Nicole said as she brought the plate of cheeses to the table and sat. She didn't want to relive the whole ordeal by telling Tony all that had happened. She could tell by the look on his face that she was going to have to do just that. "Where should I start?" "For starters, what happened at the nightclub?" Tony asked as he retrieved his wine and came over to the table to sit down with Nicole. "For starters, what happened at the nightclub?" Tony asked as he retrieved his wine and came over to the table to sit with Nicole. "It's a bit difficult to talk about, Tony. We arrived at the nightclub, and Carol was already celebrating her victory in court. Nicole began to tell the story. She mentioned how Carol made eye contact with a man with icy blue eyes who turned out to be the Serpent. Nicole was trying not to divulge too much, but she also knew that Tony would not be satisfied until he had all the pieces of the puzzle. She skipped to the part where Sean had told her she could identify the assassin and that he wanted to use her to set a trap. She skipped to the part where Sean had told her she could identify the assassin and that he wanted to use her to set a trap. She had been whisked away to North Carolina, where a dashing British agent succeeded in killing the assassin. The trap had worked. She was hopeful the information she provided, which matched the tale spun for the media, was enough to satisfy Tony's curiosity. Tony stood, walking the short distance back to the galley. He took two bowls from a cabinet and ladled some chowder into each of them. He was trying to determine how much Nicole knew and whether he wanted to continue on the subject during lunch. What an experience you had. I can certainly see why you don't like to talk about it. How Andrews was assassinated was horrific. Tony returned to the table with the soup, setting a bowl in front of Nicole before sitting back down. The papers didn't say anything about a British agent, though. No, they didn't. Nicole cringed, knowing she had made a mistake in mentioning the agent. If you could keep that quiet, I'd appreciate it. They really didn't mention much about you at all, Tony continued to prod. Whose idea was that? It was a joint decision. I really didn't want to deal with the press, and Bobby was kind enough to help draft the press release along with the investigator, Kevin Thompson. Doesn't really add up, Nikki. Why was Jenkins even involved? Tony pushed. Nicole ate some of her soup and reached for a piece of bread. She was contemplating the answer. Tony, can I trust you? What I mean to say is, if I tell you some things, you would keep it to yourself and not use it or divulge it to your Republican friends? Nicole asked. After all, I'm dating Senator Jenkins, and there are some things I know that were not disclosed in the press. I don't want Bobby put in a bad position. Tony almost dropped his spoon into the bowl. For a brief second, he wondered if Nicole knew about the tape. To find out, he knew he had to put her mind at ease. I've had a bit of falling out with my old friends, including Mark Stevens. My plans are to sail. I doubt I'll see any of those folks again. I highly doubt I'll be in this port very much in the future. I have one more official meeting as a partner in Rosen, Schaefer, and Pruitt, and then I'm leaving. Why? What happened? Nicole asked. Her confusion was genuine, and Tony could see that. He knew that Nicole wasn't talking about the tape confession. Let's just say my eyes have been open. Tony dodged the question for now. He wasn't lying either. His eyes had been opened by the Norman Sipes confession tape. There wasn't a day that went by that Tony didn't curse Sipes for having the tape delivered to him upon his death. What is it that you think can hurt Jenkins? It really wouldn't hurt Bobby. It's just something that really isn't known. He's a good friend of the British agent, so the public doesn't know how involved he was in the assassin's death, Nicole answered. He hasn't closed the investigation into the assassination, even though he is under pressure to do so. He isn't satisfied with the scenario that has played out in the press, that it was just Sipes acting on his own. That's interesting. He planted that scenario on numerous occasions. He won't name names until he has the evidence. I can only say that he is actively working on the investigation. She finished her chowder. I tried to get word to you after Carol's death, but Sean, the British agent, would not take the risk for me to do that. Bobby offered to contact you, but Sean wouldn't allow that either. I can only imagine you were worried sick about me. Nicole was trying to change the subject, but with each comment, Tony was becoming more convinced that Nicole didn't understand that she again was at the center of a developing storm. Tony smiled and finished his chowder. A lot was going on at that time, and yes, I was concerned about you. Losing Carol and then not knowing what happened to you was disconcerting. Tony stood up, picking up the bowls. Would you like any more? No, thank you. It was excellent. Where'd you learn to cook? Nicole asked, once again trying to change the subject. Tony picked up her bowl and put them in the sink in the galley. Nicole started to pick up the leftover cheeses and bread, but Tony told her to let it sit and he would get it later. Tony poured another glass of wine for each of them, explaining that he had been spending a lot of time on his boat. Because of that, he had to learn how to cook. He was no longer interested in state dinners at the White House or even dinners with old friends. I'm tired. It was hard work getting to the position of having so many favors to call in when I needed them. Most were used to keep Sipes out of trouble. That time took a lot out of me. Tony didn't mention how much he felt used and how much he had not been told. It wasn't the right time to blurt that out. He was wrestling with the idea of telling Nicole all he knew, but he wasn't sure just what that would accomplish. He walked over to the couch and Nicole followed. "So, tell me about you and Jenkins. How serious is it?" Nicole smiled. "It's pretty serious. He treats me well." She started to blush. "With his schedule on the Hill, I don't know how he finds time to make me feel special. And now with the campaign..." Tony smiled as Nicole trailed off. She took a deep breath. "Actually, in all honesty, I think he is more in love with me than I am with him at this point in our relationship." "You always found him attractive." "Yes, and he is intelligent." Nicole paused. "He's also powerful, and because of his position on various committee, he has secrets. It's just complicated at times." "And that aggravates you." It was more a statement than a question. Tony knew her too well. As they sat down on the couch, Nicole could feel a change in the air. She took a sip of her wine and placed it on the table beside the couch. She looked at Tony and could tell he was feeling uneasy. "What's wrong, Tony?" Tony hesitated. "I have something I want to say, but I'm not sure how to say it," he answered. "My stars, Tony, after all this time, you can't just say it." "I'm not sure how much I should say or even how to start." "Are you in some kind of trouble?" Nicole asked, beginning to worry. "Maybe. In a way, I am," Tony answered cryptically. "You see, I'm holding a secret that only one other person knows." "That is evident now. In fact, I'm pretty sure this other person has told you nothing about this." Tony paused as he saw Nicole's brow furrow. "This other person is someone I know?" Nicole asked. "Intimately." Tony purposely chose that word. There was only one person Nicole knew intimately at the moment. "Bobby?" "Yes," Tony confirmed. "Has he shown you a tape, a VCR tape?" "No. I mean, we watch movies, but I don't think that's what you're talking about," Nicole said. "No, it isn't a tape for entertainment." Tony paused, wondering if he should even tell Nicole. "It concerns the investigation. Or I should say, I'm concerned with Jenkins's investigation. The tape includes some evidence that should have been given to the committee. I hope he'll give it to the committee." "You're not making sense, Tony. I'm sure if you gave him some information, he would have passed it on to the committee." "I don't think he did, Nookie. This tape, it told him everything he needs to know about the assassination. It's pretty damning evidence, and quite frankly, if he had shared it properly, we'd be in the midst of a pretty big shakeup right now." "Tony, are you saying Bobby is sitting on evidence for some reason?" "I don't know. He hasn't said anything to you about it?" "I have no idea what you're talking about. What is it? What is this evidence?" Nicole asked. "Ask Jenkins," Tony answered. "If he truly loves you and wants you by his side, he should not be hiding this from you." Tony paused. "But then if he wants to use it to bribe people, maybe he wouldn't tell you." "Bribe people? I think Bobby wields enough power that he doesn't have to bribe people. Nikki, this evidence would afford him even more power." "What is on this tape?" Nicole asked forcefully. "It identifies who ordered the assassination of President Andrews," Tony answered, still trying to evade the actual contents of the tape. Nicole was taken aback. "Wait." She shook her head, trying to clear it. "Sipe paid off the assassin. It was Sipes," Nicole stated, suddenly feeling more freedom to discuss this with Tony, now that it appeared he had some knowledge of it. "It goes further than that," Tony said. "Think about it, Nikki. Sipes was broke. Do you really think he had the money to pay off an international assassin on his own?" "Are you telling me there's a cover-up and that Bobby is at the center of it?" Nicole asked. She desperately did not want to believe this. "That's a pretty bold statement, Tony." Nicole was starting to feel defensive of the man she loved. She wanted to believe Jenkins would always do the right thing. Tony, you better have some pretty strong evidence to accuse Bobby of something like this to me. Tony sat for a moment, looking Nicole in the eyes. I do. Why are you doing this? I know you never really liked him. Are you intentionally doing this to break us up or something? Tony shook his head. Sipes is not the only one responsible for the Andrews assassination. My client, my former client, wanted to make sure that fact was known. He didn't want to be the one going down in history as the person responsible. Tony sat for a moment. Tell Jenkins you want to see the tape. Ask him what he intends to do with it. He finished his wine and got up from the couch. I've probably said too much, but something needs to be done. Maybe you can light a fire under Jenkins. If not, then I'll have to do something. Tony was already making plans of what he had to do before he left Washington, D.C. for warmer waters of the Key West. Nicole stood up and put on her coat. She had so many emotions running through her. When she finished buttoning her coat, she frustratingly dropped her hands to her side. I don't know what to say. Then she recalled the reading at the party, and her mind started churning. You don't need to say anything to me. Just ask Jenkins to see the tape. Tony replied, I have no doubt that you will be great counsel to him. Maybe that's all he needs. Nicole was about to say something when Tony walked over to her and gently put his hands on her shoulders. Goodbye, Nikki. I'm not sure we'll talk again, but I want you to know that I've always had your best interests at heart, and I still do. I wish you the best with Jenkins. Here's some advice. Keep your eyes open and don't think that anyone in that circle can't hurt you. They can. They will, if you aren't part of the play. I don't think Bobby would intentionally cover something up for his gang. I can't believe that, Tony. I know you've always been jealous of him. Tony dropped his arms and looked directly at Nicole. Jealousy has nothing to do with this. Time apart has shown me you have always been interested in nothing more than being a friend. Believe me, if I wanted to get Jenkins, I would not have talked to you, he said with no hint of anger. Nicole was skilled at reading Tony, and she cocked her head when she realized that Tony was not angry. His body language indicated he was calm. That nagging tarot card flashed in her mind. She could see the lovers as plain as day. She closed her eyes to try and erase the image. I need to go. Nikki turned and walked to the door of the cabin. She turned back around to look at Tony. If you're upset with the way that Bobby is handling something, then you should go to Bobby directly. Don't expect me to deliver messages or be a pawn in whatever game you're trying to play. I'm not playing a game. You should know what Jenkins knows for your own safety. Goodbye, Nikki. He turned away from her and walked into the sleeping quarters of his yacht. Nikki left feeling frustrated with what she thought was just a play by Tony to come between her and Jenkins.